This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, tax the rich to create jobs for all.
But first, Democrats said the sweeping overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system passed by the U.S. House of Representatives would extend coverage to 36 million people now without insurance while creating a government health insurance program.
They say it will end insurance company practices like not covering pre-existing conditions or dropping people when they become ill. But what sort of coverage will the now-to-be-heavily-subsidized insurance industry provide, especially without a robust public option?
Will they truly end up extending coverage to all those eligible? And as the debate now moves to the Senate, what becomes of the single-payer option, which would cover everyone and with less cost?
We'll ask Katie Robbins, the Assistant National Coordinator of Healthcare Now, and Don McCain with the Physicians for a National Health Program, who join us now.
The fact is, I am enormously depressed. I have read some of the highlights of the provisions of what passed the House of Representatives, and it sure doesn't look to me like it's going to provide affordable health care for all. But we do have our two experts, so why don't we find out precisely what is in the bill that passed this week? And
Dave,
why don't you start with the coverage, what's covered and what the coverage will be?
The reform is based in private health plans, and the basic plans actually provide less coverage than the typical employer-sponsored plans. They provide 70% actuarial value as opposed to 80%, meaning that you have to pay more out of your pocket to get health care. So the plans are not as good. The premiums are going to be very high and unaffordable for many, especially for those individuals who don't qualify for the full subsidies of their premiums. So middle-income Americans, hardworking Americans, are going to find the plans to be unaffordable, and they're going to find the out-of-pocket expenses to also be unaffordable. When they talked about health care reform, they said, let's insure everyone and let's make health care affordable. Well, because they designed the reform around the insurance plans instead of patients, it's not working. Had we done reform that takes care of patients, you know, a single-payer Medicare for all type program, there'd be no problem. Everyone would be covered and it would be affordable for everyone. But instead, they designed the reform around private health plans, and that means that they are trying to cram patients into these nooks and crannies of the private plans, and that's not working. It's not affordable, and tens of millions of people won't fit into the system at all. So we're not ending up with the kind of reform we needed.
I'm interested in the working class and the poor. What happens to them in this bill?
The hardworking Americans, the most productive, those who are receiving insurance through their employers for the time being will be able to continue to receive that. So they won't see that much difference unless their employers have decided that the plans are just too expensive and they're going to drop them, or at least shift much more of the cost of the plans to the employees. So as healthcare costs go up, more and more is being shifted to employees. And so they're going to be hurting financially and possibly impaired access to healthcare just because of money issues.
Katie, do you agree on this question of what the Congress, actually the House of Representatives, has wrought with regard to coverage of this new group of 36 million people, which hopefully will, or they say will, be covered?
While there was much celebration of passing the Affordable Health Care for America Act this weekend, Health Care Now's view is that the House bill is remarkably inadequate. It does leave millions uninsured. It is not universal. It allows bankruptcy due to medical debt to persist. It also criminalizes the uninsured. If you do not have insurance, you will be charged a fine. And those who are covered will likely join the ranks of the underinsured. If you don't have the money to access the care, you cannot access the care when you need it. We consider that underinsurance, and that's going to grow. It really doesn't have any meaningful cost containment, and we fear that people will continue to die because of delays and denial of care, because of private insurance bureaucracy and greed. The bill's advocates claim, as you mentioned earlier, there will be an additional 36 million people covered. It will subsidize the cost of insurance for families up to 400% of the poverty level. The House bill increases Medicaid coverage from 133% of the poverty level up to 150%, which is not nothing, but we'll see what happens when it goes through the Senate. I'm not sure that increase will be in place in the final bill. And it does claim to close the Medicare donut hole by 2019. So that's something interesting, too. A lot of these provisions aren't even going into effect for 4 to 10 years. This is not reform that's happening overnight. One benefit is that in the House bill, it does place a surcharge on individuals making more than $500,000 and couples making more than $1 million, which, you know, we approve of. But with some crackdowns on the insurance industry to end the evil practices of rescission and not covering due to pre-existing conditions, those are some of the notable things. But really, is it solving the problem of a dysfunctional and unsustainable healthcare system? Unfortunately not.
Dr. McCain, whatever happened to the robust public option, which is supposed to be something good in itself, but also would whip the insurance companies into shape, be competition for them?
Well, of course, that's what the progressive community decided would solve the problem. So instead of going straight to a single-payer Medicare for All, which has a lot of resistance amongst all Republicans and the conservative Democrats, they thought that by offering a robust public option, a true Medicare-like plan that you could purchase and that anyone in the nation could purchase would be an intermediate step. And if it turned out that that was a better plan than the private plans, more people would buy it, and eventually we could end up with, or at least get much closer to Medicare for All. Well, the insurance industry was concerned that that would be the outcome, is that just as with Medicare right now, the private plans and Medicare, the Medicare Advantage plans, are much less efficient. We're paying much more. Taxpayers are paying much more for private insurance companies to provide benefits to those individuals than our traditional Medicare program. So it is more expensive to do it through private plans. And if they compete on a fair basis, which everyone says a level playing field, the government program is going to win every time because it can do it for much less money. Well, the insurance industry managed to convince members of Congress and members of the administration that that would wipe them out. And for some reason or other, the policymakers decided it's more important to take care of the private insurance industry than it is to take care of patients. So they put all kinds of restrictions on the public option, so that it just won't work. Only about 6 million people will be able to buy the public option out of 307 million people in the country. Not going to be a competitive force, and it's just that's the way the political process proceeded in Washington. And the insurance industry won, and the American people lost.
And what about the really poor? What about those who are not employed, etc.? And the masses of people, including people who are, quote-unquote, undocumented workers. What happens to them in this formulation?
They would expand Medicaid, which there's good and bad there. Medicaid is a more comprehensive program. It has very generous benefits, and the out-of-pocket costs are negligible. For many, there are no out-of-pocket costs at all. But the problem is that it's a welfare program, and as such, there's no political voice to support the program through Congress. So it's chronically underfunded. And most hospitals and doctors that see patients in the Medicaid program lose money. And so more and more physicians are unwilling to provide care to Medicaid patients. So the government is going to expand Medicaid to cover the poor people, low-income people, but they won't have access to care because they won't be able to find a doctor to take care of them. So it's back to the emergency room, which was a terrible way to provide health care services.
And Katie, the other terrible way to provide health care services is to exclude abortions from both the public option and for any of the subsidized care that would be mandated by this bill. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, it was extremely shocking and disappointing. The House of Representatives dealt a very serious blow to women's fundamental right to self-determination in order to buy a few votes for reform of the profit-driven health insurance industry. There was an amendment that passed shortly before the vote on H.R. 3962, the STUPAC amendment, which will prevent women who are receiving tax subsidies from using their own money to purchase private insurance that covers abortion, and in many cases prevent low-income women from accessing abortion entirely. It's incredibly regressive. There needs to be serious protest because of the passage of the STUPAC amendment. We need to make it clear that this cannot continue through the final process of the bill and urge the Senate to pass legislation that does not include the kind of restrictions that the House bill does on abortion. It's incredibly shocking.
And Katie, where do we go from here? It seems like the Senate bill will be, if anything, more restrictive. And is there any hope for the Kucinich amendments that would allow states to opt into single payer?
According to these recent statements that Dennis Kucinich has put out, there is an opportunity for his amendment, which did pass the Education and Labor Committee in the House with bipartisan support. The Kucinich amendment essentially provides for waivers that make implementing a single-payer system on the state level very difficult. So it would pave the way. It would make it easier for states to implement a single-payer system. And this is critical. We have amazingly energetic state movements for single-payer around the country. California, for example, has passed their single-payer bill twice, and it's been vetoed twice. So they're really looking for something like the Kucinich Amendment to pave the way and make it even easier for them to reach that goal. Kucinich was saying, the insurance industry is lobbying heavily to prevent that amendment from going into the final legislation. But it's possible that it could be reinserted later on in this process when the House and Senate have their conference committee to merge the two bills that passed. So we urge people to contact their representative to reinstate the Kucinich amendment in this legislation. We'll also see Senator Sanders bring single-payer bill S-703 to the floor of the Senate for a vote. And there's different rules in the Senate, so we don't anticipate any complications with him doing that. So we will see for the first time in this nation's history of debate, discussion, and vote on single-payer in the Senate, which is historic. We need to continue to demand that the Senate pass a health care bill that respects women's constitutionally protected right to abortion among these single-payer strategies as well.
And Dr. McCain, in 30 seconds, why don't the American people get it more? Why aren't they rising up in a unified voice to push for what is elementary in virtually every other industrial country in the world?
There's a certain amount of fear. They're worried about their own position, especially those who have employer-sponsored coverage. They feel sort of comfortable with that unless they have to use it. Many of them find out it doesn't work very well. For some, it does work. But when, with all of the right-wing garbage about the government can't do anything right and the government interfering with health care and on, people are a little apprehensive about that. And they really don't understand how well the government works. Medicare is an example of it's working very well, much better than the private sector. And if people could only get that concept through their mind that they're willing to trade their private insurance plan for a less expensive, more effective public program, then we'd have it. But so far, people really haven't gotten that message.
Well, thank you both, Don McCain with Physicians for a National Health Program and Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator of Healthcare Now. Well, sooner or later, we are going to get that single-payer system. Get rid of those insurance companies and make healthcare really affordable and quality for all who need it. Thank you both for joining us.
And now with the official national unemployment rate exceeding 10% and the real rate way above that, we present Bill Barkley from the Chicago Political Economy Group, who presented one of the many proposals for full employment offered at the National Jobs for All Coalition Conference held in New York City November 13th through 14th. This proposal is paid for by a redistribution of wealth, including a national stock transfer tax, and increased inheritance taxes on the wealthy.
July of 1932, the Democratic Party met in the city of Chicago to nominate their candidate for president. The party had won the presidency only four times since the 1850s. The city they met in, Chicago, was under economic siege. 45% of the population that had a job 2 years before was unemployed. And they finally nominated a man they considered to be a political lightweight, a man we know as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt's campaign didn't talk about unemployment. In fact, he spent a fair amount of time attacking Hoover for running deficits. But Chicago had made an impact on Roosevelt. A few days after he got in office, he called his staff together and said, I want to put 500,000 young men, and it was men, as Helen noted, to work by the summer. They said it could not be done. The military said this is logistically impossible. He had went away a few days, came back a few days later, said, all right, 250,000. He wasn't an economist. He had just picked the number out of air and thought it was nice. They put almost 300,000 people to work in what became known as Civilian Conservation Corps by June, the first of several million. Roosevelt recognized they faced a crisis of jobs. We recognize that we face that same crisis today. The numbers may not be as high, although it's close to 20% when you count the unemployed, underemployed, discouraged, et cetera, workers. I've been asked to talk about the Chicago Political Economy Group's proposal for job creation. And one of the most encouraging things so far today is that there's a lot of convergence between what I've heard other groups are thinking and what we've been thinking. I want to make two points to begin with. When we started thinking about this, it was in early 2008, before the cascade of job losses. Secondly, we started from six propositions that were not axioms, but came from our analysis of the U.S. political economy. First, that the U.S. economy had failed over the long term to generate sufficient jobs, much less sufficient good jobs, to meet the needs of our population. For at least 30 years, interestingly enough, a 30-year period or 30-year plus period that coincides with the rise of the finance sector. Secondly, that the jobs that are created, both in general and the good ones, are unequally distributed because we have a segmented labor market, a segmented labor force by race, by gender, by ethnicity. The median income for a full-time working woman is about 67% of the median income for a full-time working man. Median income of full-time working African-American, about 63% of the median income for a full-time working Caucasian. Thirdly, the lack of jobs is not because there's a lack of work to do. There's plenty of work to do in terms of infrastructure, in terms of social investment, et cetera. Fourthly, that the fact that the private sector has failed to do this says that there's an important role for government, federal, state, and local level, in terms of generating these jobs, both at the macro level and in terms of making sure that there's access across the stratified labor force to these good jobs. Fifthly, if the private sector has failed for so long, it means that any kind of government role is going to have to be long-term, not temporary, not stopgap. And lastly, and this may be the most controversial one, but I think it's crucial, that not only should the program be redistributive in terms of its impact in making sure that people who have had trouble getting access to the good jobs get access, it must also be redistributive in terms of its funding, in terms of how we pay for it. That is to say, we're designing a program here that is about jobs, yes, but is also about transforming the nature of the U.S. political economy in the process. The result was what we called a permanent jobs program in the U.S., economic restructuring to meet human needs. Now, I can easily summarize our program in one sentence. Proposal was to create 5 million new jobs per year over each of 5 years. But there are some specifics that I think are worth talking about, both in terms of the nature of the jobs, in terms of how much it'll cost, and how we would pay for it. The 5 million number incorporates both jobs created by the program and the jobs that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, assumes will be generated by the private sector. Now, we identified three areas in which the focus of the program should be in terms of job creation. One, of course, is fairly traditional: redoing, updating, refurbishing our infrastructure. About 2 million of the job loss since December of 2007 are in construction. And those people who worked in that area, which is 95% male, if you look at the most recent occupational statistics, heavily Caucasian, would be the primary beneficiaries of this area of the jobs program. This is only one of three. There's the rebuilding of our roads, our bridges. There's the rehabbing of our hospitals, our schools, et cetera. So that's one of the targets. Second target would be expanding public employment in human needs and social needs. Here we're talking about health, education, including things like elder care, care for young children, assistance in teaching classrooms, redoing our parks and recreation. One of the things that strikes me every time I go to a national park and my wife drags along the WPA guide is how much we owe to what they did in the 1930s and how little has been done since then. So there's lots of work here. This would tend to draw jobs or allocate jobs more towards women and towards minorities. About 75% of the people employed in education and in healthcare are female, and about 25% of those are African American. So again, we're recognizing we have a segmented labor market, segmented labor force. We have to have a jobs program that reaches across all sectors. Third and last would be to focus on the new energy technologies of the future. But we do need to have an industrial policy in this area, and believe me, industrial policies work. Just ask the Scandinavians if somebody tells you they don't. You can also ask the Chinese. They work there as well, and they worked for the Japanese in the 50s and the 60s. What do we mean by good jobs? One, we mean that they would be well paid, and we think that means they should be paid at the median salary, which is $18 an hour. Secondly, the jobs have access to the right to decide to associate together and speak for themselves in terms of how they want to control and organize their work, i.e. unions. Thirdly, they should get whatever benefits are made available under whatever health care package we finally managed to get out of this legislature this year or next year. What would this program cost? Remember, we're talking about cohorts that build up over time. Each individual cohort will cost about $175.5 billion in that year. Now, that's only about 1.25% of the GDP. But by the time you're doing this for the fifth year, you've got five cohorts, and you're talking about $877.5 billion. We came up with this number in August of 2008, and we have people gone away doing work, and they brought it back, and they shared it around with all. We sat there in our group and said, wow, that's really a lot of money. 2 months later, we found out that really wasn't all that much money, because when you need to spend $800-900 billion, it's there, you can spend it, there's no problem. But let's talk about how we'd finance that, because I think that's very important. And I'm going to focus on a couple of things rather than going through all of these, because I spent most of my working career in financial services, including, I almost hesitate to say this, developing a couple of derivative products. So I do know something about the finance sector. In addition to the fact that it is clear that the unrestrained growth of the finance sector in our economy, and not just our economy, you can look at the UK economy, you can look at the Spanish economy, but particularly the US, has been the major impetus behind the crisis in which we now find ourselves. So that in terms of poetic or political justice, there's certainly a reason to impose some kind of taxation in the finance sector. But it's also economically important because we do need to bring this sector back into its appropriate role in the economy. Finance does have a role in terms of allocating capital. But when you look at a situation as we have in this country where profits of financial corporations, a percent of total business profits, went from under 20% in the mid-1970s to almost 45% in 2005, things have gotten out of hand. So what we decided to do was to employ a measure or propose a measure that has a very long pedigree. The most recent advocate of this measure, by the way, were Larry and Victoria Summers. Yes, that Larry Summers. 20-some years ago, they wrote an article arguing for a securities transaction excise tax. Of course, John Maynard Keynes and James Tobin have made similar arguments. Now, by a very narrow calculation, if you just looked at the value of stock trading in the U.S. last year, it was around 65 or 66 trillion. That's trillion with a T. And if you tax that at 0.25% on each side of the transaction, you'd raise about $350 billion. If you only want to do it on one side, you raise $175 billion. The stock market is the smallest of the three markets that need to be taxed in the financial area: stocks, debt, that is bonds, and currencies. So when you put all these together, I think we've come up with a figure around $500 billion that we think could be raised from there. Secondly, picked up something from the Obama campaign. He had a proposal at one point, I haven't heard much of it recently, about an income tax surcharge on families or household incomes over $250,000 a year, roughly the top 2.5% of household income. That would raise around $100 to $150 billion a year. We would also, of course, think that you should scale back spending on the military. We said we recognize that a lot of other people have programs that want to use the money that's taken from the military, so we said only apply $100 billion of this back to this kind of program. The last one I'll note here is dealing with the estate tax. Conservatives like to call this the death tax. I think it's a Paris Hilton tax, because it's the tax that will prevent us from having more Paris Hiltons, with all that money to spend and not much good sense to spend it with. Under a Bush sleight of hand, this has been manipulated for the last few years, but it comes back in 2010. It needs to come back, be made progressive, and taken seriously. We all pay a wealth tax. Most of us may not think about that, but if you pay a property tax either because you own a home or because you rent, you are paying a tax on your wealth. The difference is the tax that most of us are paying on our wealth, our most important single asset, our residence, is many times 80, 85% of our wealth. For the top 5% or so of the population, that's not true. Most of their wealth is in other forms. So there needs to be a serious wealth tax that applies across the board. If we took a wealth tax of 0.5% on the top 1% of wealth holders, that is those with wealth over $5 million, we'd raise close to $100 billion. So the question, it seems to me, or seems to us, because I'm speaking for the group, is not can we afford to do this, or is the fiscal cupboard bare? The fiscal cupboard is not bare. Our approach, I guess, was sort of analogous to that of Willie Sutton when asked, why did he rob banks? He said, because that's where the money is. Our approach is to look where the money is, and the money is in the finance sector and in that incredible concentration of income and wealth. And this is important politically, because if we don't change this concentration of income and wealth, those $4 million campaigns are going to become $6 million campaigns and $8 million campaigns, and it's possible because a small group, a financial elite, have so much money that they can spend. We're not going to reverse our political problem if we don't go after that as well. So yes, a jobs program, but the jobs program needs to be redistributive in terms of allocation of jobs and in terms of paying for it.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.